If you're involved in cybersecurity, you want to make sure that your computer system can't be hacked. And it's no good just sort of feeling confident that you've designed a good system. You need to test it out. And apparently what companies do, they can sometimes set up a red team and a blue team. It's the red team's job to try and hack the system. It's the blue team's job to try and stop them. And it's a similar approach you can take in other areas too. This is something I think that has come from the military. If you're going to war, it's no good just thinking, oh yeah, we're invincible. You need to think about what are your weaknesses. If you were the enemy, how would you respond? And there's the danger of what's sometimes called sort of groupthink, where all the advisors say the same thing. No one questions whether they are right. No one challenges what seems to be obvious or sometimes just what you want to believe. I wonder how much groupthink there was in the Kremlin before the invasion of Ukraine. But here's the thing. We see the need to be self-critical when it comes to cybersecurity or military security. But what about our eternal security? I'm always amazed how people can be uncertain about all sorts of issues. You can ask them about stuff, oh, I don't really know what I think about that. But when it comes to something about religion, utterly certain of their view, utterly certain of the rightness of their view. Oh, I'm certain there's no God. I'm certain I'm going to heaven. And refuse to listen to anything that might challenge that confidence. Well, you know, to become a true Christian involves realizing that you are wrong. It actually involves realizing you've been deceived, self-deceived. You're wrong about your own goodness. You're actually not as good as you thought. You come to see you've been wrong about God as well. He's not some sort of spiritual teddy bear or a magic genie or an evil dictator. He's a wonderful Lord and Savior. And in fact, you come to see that sin itself has blinded you to the truth. So all of that makes it actually very odd when you come across Christians who are not self-critical. Christians who are always so sure they're right. Normally it's particularly about the end times. They're very unwilling to be challenged. They won't distinguish their understanding with what God has actually said. Now, don't misunderstand me. We can be confident in God. We can be confident in God's word. I don't have a problem with any red team challenging my beliefs about Jesus and his resurrection. We don't need protection as Christians from robust questioning. We don't need some sort of safe space, you know, that we're afraid if someone's going to question our views. Not at all. We don't need to worry about any red team because God is the blue team. We don't have a problem with that. I can, I should, I must be confident in God. But I need to be very suspicious of myself, of my understanding, my interpretation, my motives, my wisdom, my blind spots, if only I could see them. Well, the nation that Amos was speaking to Israel in the mid-700s BC, well, they'd lost any concept of self-deception. In their prosperity and peace, they were supremely confident. And they knew their religion. They knew what any preacher would come along and say next. You know, they could complete the sentences for the preacher. You know, the preacher starts on a topic, they would know exactly what he was going to say. Except for Amos. Amos was this master preacher who gets under their skin, who exposes their self-deception. And there's really a gear change here in the prophecy in verse 18. And you get the same in chapter 6, verse 1, where he says, "Woe to you." There's a greater intensity, directness in his warning. He's saying, "Woe to you." He's saying, "You are in trouble, and this is why you're in trouble. And this is what is going to happen." That's what he's doing in this passage before us this morning. And he begins with this idea of the day of the Lord to expose something of their blindness and deception. When you think about it, that title there is a little strange, isn't it? Blind to deception. It has to be true, doesn't it? Because if you're not blind to it, you wouldn't be deceived. But I put it like that because that's the point, isn't it? We are blind to deception. Now, this is the first time we actually find this phrase, the day of the Lord, in the Bible. But it was clearly something that was familiar to the people that Amos was speaking to. An idea that they talked about, and they're really referring here to sort of past, particularly military victories, where God had powerfully delivered his people. And what they were doing was really looking back to these past glories, if you like, to bring hope for the future. They were looking for God to do that in the present. And actually, politicians do this all the time today. You know, they look back to these sort of glories of the past as somehow a reason that we should be hopeful about the future. They were looking forward to this future final victory and deliverance for the nation. And they were deeply sincere about this. They long for the day of the Lord. That's speaking of intense hunger and thirst. This was something all-consuming. And it was a sort of national assumption. There was this, if you like, groupthink. Everyone thought the same about this. They were longing for this day. Because after all, they were the Lord's people. They were the descendants of Abraham. They were the chosen nation. They'd been rescued from Egypt centuries before. God is the one who he'd revealed his name in particular to them. You know, the day of the Lord, well, that's his name. Well, they're his people. They know his name. And so as Amos starts to talk about the day of the Lord, they know what he's going to say. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. It's going to be that day of victory, that day of light, that day of vindication. Except Amos doesn't say that. He rather begins with a woe. It's a day of darkness. That means it's a day of danger, not of security. It's the day of the Lord, but you're meeting God as your enemy, not as your friend. And they would have been left stunned hearing this. That sort of stomach-dropping moment, as what you were so sure of is sort of overturned. Maybe getting your exam results or something, and you were so sure you did really well in one of those subjects, and you open the results, and it's a totally different result to what you were expecting. Your stomach just drops. Or you go to work, and the boss wants to see you, and you're sure you've done such a good piece of work, you're going to get promotion. And instead, you're told you're being fired. Total turnaround. Or a relationship you thought was going well, only for it to be ended. That turnaround. And these people have forgotten that the day of the Lord is actually something a little ambiguous, isn't it? It's a bit like someone saying it's a day to remember, or you're going to have an unforgettable holiday. It could be good or bad. But they were sure it was going to be good. They assumed that God was on their side. They had this sort of sense of entitlement. This is what I deserve. This is what God owes us. It's God's job to forgive and to rescue. He's a God who's kind. And if they were challenged, consider the kindness and sternness of God, to quote Paul's words in Romans 11, their sort of groupthink wouldn't shift. They would sort of say, well, okay, yeah, there is judgment, but that's for other people, other nations, not God's people, Israel. And if they were challenged again, and someone pointed out, well, actually, in chapter 4, Amos was talking about judgment that happened to Israel too, they would say, okay, but I'm still here. I'm okay. I dodged the bullet. I survived cancer. I survived the crash. I'll be okay. God won't judge me. At which point, Amos steps in with verse 19. It will be as though a man fled from a lion only to meet a bear. as though he entered his house, rested his hand on the wall, only to have a snake bite him. It's almost worthy of Mr. Bean, isn't it? That image. And yet it's something deadly serious. At a basic level, he's saying, you can't escape. You won't escape. But I think he's actually saying something, in a way, even deeper than that, when you think of the connections here. Meeting this lion, and indeed the bear, those were unexpected dangers. But who's the lion? The lion is God. The lion roars, we're told, at the beginning of Amos. It's talking about God's voice. And this bear, it's not some teddy bear. It's a dangerous bear, like the bears that, what did they do? That mauled the people that mocked an earlier prophet, Elisha. And so you flee from the lion and the bear, and you get to the safety of home, and you're bitten by a snake. I think the message is this. When you run from God, you're left with the snake, with the serpent, with Satan. You're left deceived. The sort of message of the Bible in a snapshot in that one verse. Run from God, you end up with the snake, deceived. And so the question is, are you deceived about God? Is he some sort of teddy bear, some magic genie for you, someone to be manipulated to meet your desires? Or is he the lion that roars, who judges? Are you deceived about hell? Hell exists, you think, but it's essentially empty, apart from maybe Judas and Hitler. Is anyone here, is anyone in this congregation expecting to end up in hell? If you went round Gravesend today and did a survey, do you expect to be in heaven or hell when you die? Almost everyone who said, well, I don't believe in either, would say heaven. In which case, where are they this morning? Because the only way to heaven is in trusting Jesus, in following him, and that will involve being with his people. Hell is not empty. And the day of the Lord is a day of justice, which means God will judge the wrong in you as well as the wrong in others. Or are you blind to your sin too? Here's the second thing here. The people were blind to their sin. Amos explains the reason they're in danger. And it's another surprise. Because what does he do? He highlights their religious devotion. And you think, well, surely that's good. And yet he's highlighting that as being the problem. And he's using really strong language here to try and get across this, because again, as people listen to preachers, they always filter what a preacher says with what they think the preacher is saying. And so he has to really make the point here. And it's almost as if sort of God grabs the microphone at this point. There's no sort of introduction, thus says the Lord. It's God speaking directly. He sort of grabs the microphone and says what? I hate, I despise, I cannot stand, I will not accept, I have no regard. Away with the noise. I will not listen. When God says he despises the religious feasts, he's really saying they stink. I can't bear the smell. And there's something awful, isn't there, about a terrible smell? That's one of the things that's most impossible to endure. There's something noxious. These sacrifices that were meant to be a sweet-smelling smell to God were noxious. And when he says he has no regard for these offerings, he's saying, I can't bear to look at them. They make me vomit. Basically, God's reaction to the sacrifices of his people is the same as his reaction to the religion of the Canaanite people that they'd driven out of the land. And you can imagine the people thinking, what are you on about, Amos? We are doing what God commanded. Surely God is pleased. The festivals, well, these were the annual festivals that God commanded. In verse 22, there are three types of offering. They're exactly the offerings that are set out in Leviticus 1, 2, and 3. They're even in order. The songs. Well, where did they come from? Well, great King David of all people, the man after God's own heart. He was the one that gave a great place to music and song in the worship of God. Surely these things are right. But look at what is missing. This is actually always very important. If you're trying to test someone's teaching, someone's theology, look at what people don't say as well as what they do say. What you discover here is the people were rather selective in their obedience. It was a pick and mix religion, and they picked and chose. Interestingly, there's no sin offering here. Just as we saw in chapter 4. That's the next one in Leviticus 4. But there's no mention of it here. And there's no justice and righteousness in their life either. That isn't rolling like a river in their lives, in their society. And in verse 26, they have idols that they've made for themselves, something that Stephen highlights in the New Testament in his speech in Acts 7. So you can divide up the problem, I think, in sort of two headings, and they're sort of, you almost can't separate the two things, but let's try it in this way. They didn't love God. They had sinful worship. They had a religion, but it was a sort of a tick box religion. They were doing some of the right things, but not out of any heart for God. They didn't have a love for God. Notice how God describes it as your assemblies, your feasts, your songs. It was all about them, not God. It was a religion of a sort of transaction, a business deal. You know, give God his sacrifices so he'll leave me alone to live as I like. And God was not unique or special to them. He was worshipped alongside idols. He was treated the same as an idol. And I think that is why these sacrifices are so offensive. What was meant to be this exclusive relationship between God and his people? When they're being unfaithful in this way, it makes these sacrifices deeply offensive. It's a bit like an adulterous husband or wife persisting in that adultery and then giving a birthday present or something. It makes a mockery of the relationship. You know, you think, well, giving a birthday present is good. Not in that context, it isn't. There's something deeply broken about what is going on. And it makes a mockery of God to bring these sacrifices when the people are living in this way. God isn't fooled. God isn't manipulated. And we need to make sure we are not self-deceived. It is so easy to be involved in churches, to be involved in religious activity where it's actually about me, not God. Many people will go along to church things because they enjoy the music or because they enjoy intellectual sermons or something or the ornate building or whatever it might be. It's about the event. It's not about God. God isn't the attraction. Or it's a lifestyle choice. People have said to me in years gone by, oh, I like coming to church because it makes me feel calmer. It's a calming thing. It helps me. That's dangerous. Or it's just a place where you can socialize. Again, the focus is about you. It's not on God. God isn't the attraction. Or where you move from church to church once a church doesn't give you what you want. You're shopping around. We can do this in lots of ways. And you can also apply this to other commands of God. Even this command of doing justice and righteousness that the people were not following here. it is possible for people to be really into social action. But they're not doing it out of love for God. They're doing it for themselves. It makes them feel better. It makes them feel valued or needed. It means they're someone who can make a difference. Our hearts can be very twisted. But of course, it was that sort of life Amos's hearers were not doing. There was not a life that was consistent with their worship. They didn't see how their worship in the sanctuary needed to extend to all of life. There had to be that consistency between their worship and their life. That righteousness, if you like, is a seamless robe. You can't pick and choose it. And they were really following the thinking of the nations around in this. And you get the same in other religions today, where basically if you do the right religious things, if you turn up at the right prayer times, you eat the right food, you wear the right clothes, you can do what you like to your wife. You can be corrupt as you like in business or whatever. If you like, religion sort of gives you cover for an immoral life. That's how the nations around saw it. And that is how Israel was beginning to operate. But you can't put the real God in a box in that way. And again, Christians today can treat, I just want to put it like this, Christians can treat sort of Christianity like Narnia, that world of C.S. Lewis. You go into the wardrobe, you enter that religious life where you talk and sing a lot about Jesus. But then you come back out again and you go about your normal everyday life. That talk and song about Jesus has no connection to the real world, no connection to how you live in your daily life, to who you sleep with, to what you watch, to how you spend your money. But Jesus isn't Lord of Narnia. He's Lord of this world. He's Lord over all your life. And Amos's particular point here is that love for God, living for God, is seen in how you treat other people. Justice inevitably involves other people, doesn't it? That's the whole point. You can't therefore have a private religion. Again, many Christians want to have their private religion. It's about me and my quiet times with God. And who needs church? Because people are difficult. And they say, well, I'm not doing any harm to anyone. But justice requires that you're positively doing good. That involves serving other people, and you can't do that on your own. You can't just have a private religion with you in your quiet times. It has to be seen in your life with other people. And I think this is what Amos is getting at in verse 25, where he reminds the self-deceived of their history. Did you bring me sacrifices and offerings for 40 years in the desert, O house of Israel? It's a question. But what's the answer? Is it yes or no? It's actually, I think, a bit tricky. Probably yes. They did bring sacrifices, and yet when you read through Exodus to Deuteronomy, there's lots of teaching about sacrifices, but very little of actually bringing those sacrifices, because it was teaching about what they were to do once they were in the promised land. So I think there's an ambiguity there. So what's Amos getting at? I think he's saying this. Was it really only sacrifices that the people brought? So they brought these sacrifices and then just lived as they like? Not at all. The same law that set out the sacrifices said, do not pervert justice. And in particular, singled out the vulnerable and the weak, the foreigner, the fatherless, the widow, for justice, for fair treatment, for care. It was all part of following God, the sacrifices and also how you treated other people. And it's a message we get all through the Bible. What you think of God, how you treat God, is going to be seen in how you treat other people. Look at what James says. religion that that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. There's something beautifully ordinary about that, isn't there? Sometimes when we hear this talk of social justice, we think, oh, parliamentary campaigns, social reforms. And for a few suitably gifted people, that may be how they work this out. But that isn't going to be what it is for most people. Understand that social justice comes very close to home. It's about how you treat your spouse and your children and your parents. It's about not gossiping. Gossip is injustice. It's about there being no place for pornography. That is an example of oppression and injustice. It's about caring for the lonely. It's hard. It's costly. But it's how we worship God. Proverbs 21:3. To do what is right and just is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. But not only were Amos's hearers deceived about their worship, they were also deceived about their future. So Amos tells them what will happen. Verse 27, I will send you into exile beyond Damascus. And that's exactly what happened. In 722 BC, just a few decades, less than the 40 years even that the people of Israel were in the wilderness, just a few decades after Amos was speaking, those words came to pass. And they were taken to Assyria. And how did you get to Assyria? Through Damascus. But that was exactly not what Israel was expecting. Because as Amos was speaking, things were going really well. We'll see more of that next time. They were militarily as strong as they'd ever been. And Assyria was not a great power. They were in a time of weakness. So they were self-deceived about their future. But they shouldn't have been, because God had been very clear. Back in Deuteronomy 28, he warns them that this is their future if this is the life they persist in. And to be in exile is to be removed from the land of blessing that God had given. From the, if you like it, the land was God's home. So to be taken into exile means that you are separated from God and his goodness and his blessing. And so exile is a picture, an example, really, of what God's word warns us of today. The separation from God forever in hell. And understand, there is justice in this. God was giving the people what they'd chosen. The people in Amos's time treated God like an idol, someone to serve them, someone to meet their needs. And they worshipped instead created things, things that they'd made for themselves, as it says in verse 26. So what's going to happen? They're rejecting God. They're turning to these things that they've made. Well, they will live in a land that is ruled by those idols. Verse 26 is tricky to translate. If you look at the sort of footnote in the NIV, it's basically talking there about Assyrian idols that they were following. Well, you're going to go to the land of Assyria, and you can be ruled by those gods, and you can see what sort of life that is like. Those are idols that you worship, but they won't deliver. They look impressive, but they're empty, and in fact, it's worse than that. They're deceptive. They're dangerous. It's like having this sort of beautifully wrapped present, but inside, it's even worse than simply being empty. Inside is poison. That is what it means to follow these idols. So don't be deceived about your future. The day of the Lord is the day of Jesus' return. So hear his warning. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. See, they've got his name right. But only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and perform many miracles? Not even false miracles, many miracles. Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Those are Jesus' words. These people were doing religious things in Jesus' name. And they get a response that they were not expecting. It was not the future they expected. So how on earth can you make sure that isn't you? What's the answer? Is it to ditch religion? Don't bother with all this church and Bible stuff. No, 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 that isn't what Amos is saying. That isn't what Jesus is saying. Well, is it that we should focus more on social justice? Well, that's a good thing, but that's not going to rescue anyone from hell. The answer to this is the person who is speaking. It is Jesus himself. And I wonder, did you spot Jesus here in this reading? Or are you blind to him too? Are you blind both to the problem and to the solution? Because I think we find Jesus here in verse 24. Let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. What God requires is righteousness and justice. Doing what is right, putting right what is wrong. That sort of sums up his whole covenant with Israel and actually what he requires of each one of us. But note how it's described. It's a stream. It's a river. Well, that's something pretty precious in a dry climate. And a stream and a river is meant to be something continual, something forever. Not seasonal, like the sort of streams you had in Israel. They would flow some of the time. Not stop and start. So it's not, well, I'm righteous some of the time, or even, well, I've only been unfaithful once. That is a bit like saying that the Titanic was a successful voyage, because there were 4 days of trouble-free sailing. Come on, you know, look at that. There's only the sinking at the end. Come on, look at the 4 days of good sailing. Well, that's ridiculous, because the whole point of the Titanic was to stay afloat for the whole journey. And God has made us to be people of righteousness and justice all the time. But we don't. We distort justice for our own selfish ends, and even when we do what is right, we quickly run out of steam. So there's a deep irony in God's words. He's saying, you know, let justice roll on like a river. But he knows it's not going to happen. Not with Amos's hearers or with us. So where do we find a righteousness and justice that doesn't fail, that is perfect, that is everlasting? Well, the answer is in God. My righteousness draws near speedily. My salvation is on the way. My arm will bring justice to the nations. My salvation will last forever. My righteousness will never fail. God is the life-giving stream. He is constant. He never runs out. And so it means there will be no righteousness and justice without God. That's why you can't give up on true religion. And we see it in Jesus. This verse that we quoted at the start of the service, this is speaking of Jesus. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. Look at Jesus' life and you see righteousness and justice. Perfect, continual, never wavering. You see Jesus' life and you see something very beautiful, something very wonderful. And you see that beauty in his death as well. In his death, we see the answer to our sin and injustice, dying in the place of sinners. That's the answer. So don't be deceived. This lion in Amos is Jesus. Don't run from the lion and end up with the snake. Run to Jesus. Turn to him. Trust him. And you will live under his righteousness and justice forever in his kingdom. That's where that righteousness and justice is found. Let's finish with a song that speaks of Jesus' coming again. This is the day of the Lord that is to come. And he is coming back. Surely, Christ is surely coming, bringing his reward, Alpha and Omega, first and last and Lord.